Welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Nonprofits across the nation are worried about what could happen if the federal budget is slashed. Many receive monies awarded to their states. With Medicaid and arts and culture funding in jeopardy, Nick Johnson says nonprofits are wise to look beyond their usual income streams and move to better collaborate with each other within and across nonprofit sectors. Nick Johnson is the Senior Vice President for State Fiscal Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He's on his way to Honolulu from Washington, D.C., for tomorrow's conference at the Hawaii Community Foundation. We talked as he was waiting for his plane, and I asked him what he sees that could especially affect Hawaii and its nonprofits.
I think nonprofit organizations have real reason to be concerned. They provide crucial services in the community, whether it's healthcare or education, arts programs, any number of services that nonprofits provide. And we're facing some real dangers from what might be coming down the pipeline at the federal level. I guess I have a couple of observations about it. One is that the federal budget debate is far from over. There are serious proposals at the table. There are cuts on the table. There have been cuts in the past. There will be cuts in the future. But the debate is not over, and it is still very much being informed by what lawmakers are hearing from folks on the ground. It's really important that they hear from nonprofits all around the country about exactly what the impact of budget cuts will be. So I think part of it is don't give up on the federal debate just yet. I think the other part is to continue to work with state lawmakers to think about, in the absence of positive federal policies, what can the state do a little differently to lay out a different path forward from what the federal government may be doing.
As you have been talking to states around the country, what specific things are you advising them, and what things might you say that Hawaii should look at a little differently?
Well, the first step is that I think a lot of states are taking something of a wait-and-see attitude. Certainly in this last legislative session, you saw a lot of governors and a lot of legislators essentially try to do no harm in the short run. So I think that, and that's a sound, given the somewhat chaotic nature of the debates in Washington right now, that's a really sound strategy. But again, the same, what I just said about nonprofits goes for governors and legislators and city council members and really anyone involved in civic life. What we're seeing in the federal debates right now, it's somewhat surprising. You know, if you followed the campaign last year, the all the discussion of fake news and do facts still matter, and I think a lot of folks were wondering, God, it seems like facts don't matter anymore. The reality is what we're seeing in the first 8 months of this year is that facts matter incredibly, especially when that's facts on the ground being articulated by the people who are most affected by them, ordinary folks who are the beneficiaries of services, as well as folks who are running nonprofits, policymakers, being able to be that voice and say, here's what's going to happen if, for instance, there are deep cuts to the Medicaid program, which provides health care for lots and lots of families and seniors and people with disabilities.
Obviously, Medicaid is a big issue for every state. Certainly it is in Hawaii. That's only one part of what might be compromised. I'm also concerned, though, that nonprofits may or may not be looking at how they are or aren't working together in a situation that inherently may be, you know, pitting some of them against themselves.
Yeah, that's a big concern, and it's a potential problem. It's a natural temptation for anyone who is running a nonprofit agency or a staff member at a nonprofit agency or a board member to think first and foremost about their organization and about the slices of the budget that come through to them. But the reality is that nonprofits really have a shared stake in the budget as a whole. And it's at crisis moments like this when I think folks are most tempted to double down and focus just on the slice of the pie that directly affects them. But actually, it's most important that they step back and think about the folks in the community that they're serving and all the programs that might affect them, and that they work together to have a shared voice. Because that's the other piece of this is it's one thing for one little nonprofit in one neighborhood or one community to speak up. It's so much more powerful when they work together with a shared voice and a shared vision.
You're coming to Hawaii to speak at the Hawaii Community Foundation Conference on Thursday. What specific message do you have for those foundations and others who might yet, you know, come into being because of needs that they're beginning to see in the community and a wish to collaborate in ways that we perhaps haven't seen in the same ways that you're advocating now?
Yeah, my message is pretty straightforward. I mean, it's basically one part bad news and two parts good news. And the one part bad news is indeed the proposals that we're seeing at the federal level to cut Medicaid, to cut the SNAP program, to change the tax code so that there's less revenue in the future to pay for some of these programs, and to cut the overall category of federal spending that funds lots and lots of different programs, from education to childcare to roads. So the bad news is that there are proposals on the table that would not just cut funding, but actually transform some of these programs to make them less and less adequate to meet needs into the future. So that's the one part bad news. The good news is, again, we are seeing debates over these budget proposals that are proving that facts do matter. Policymakers are really paying attention to how many people would lose health insurance under proposals to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. What would the hit be to food banks and community shelters from cuts to programs like the SNAP program? So part of the good news is I really believe that we are seeing in the last few months proof that information transmitted from the people who are really seeing it happen on the ground can actually change what lawmakers do. The second piece of good news is about nonprofits in general. And again, as you alluded to a minute ago, the power that they have to work together, to work collaboratively on the shared voice, and the importance of doing just that. I'm excited to be part of this amazing conference agenda that the Hawaii Community Foundation folks have put together, to be joined by such amazing civic leaders. And I think it's really a feather in the cap of the community in Hawaii that a conference like this is coming together.
I want to thank you very much for the time that you were able to give us, and wish you all the best as you get on that plane.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Nick Johnson is the Senior Vice President for State Fiscal Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. It's a Washington, D.C. research and policy institute. He'll be speaking at tomorrow's Hawaii Community Foundation Conference.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, bring the classical ballet of the Russian Masters to Honolulu. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we remember the last independent Ali'i Nui, who managed to hold on to rule over his island well after Kamehameha I had conquered the other ruling chiefs. He was born around 1778 and reigned from 1794 to 1810. He began his rule at the age of 16 and was guided by a regency until he came of age. It took Kamehameha 3 separate attempts over 14 years before he was able to overthrow the island's chief. In 1810, Kamehameha assembled an armada equipped with European weapons that would have devastated the small island kingdom, and the man whose name we're looking for today elected to sue for peace. He continued to serve his people as governor of his former kingdom until his death in 1824. And as you're listening to the rebroadcast of the conversation, no one will be available to take your call if you are trying to answer the backyard quiz, but you can always call us when we're live in the 11 o'clock hour.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
For many, the late George Balanchine was the dominant choreographer of the past century, himself in a direct line of succession to the great dance masters of his Russian past. Whether or not you absorb his influence, you can't escape it. Balanchine's legacy remains strongest in the New York City Ballet, and Yvonne Bure was a principal dancer in that company. Learning his technique and his ballets, all of them classics of the modern repertoire, she's in Hawaii to become the director of Honolulu's Alive Ballet Academy. She's offering a free open masterclass this Saturday, and she's with us in our studio. Hi, Yvonne. Thanks for coming in.
Aloha, Mr. Vandercook. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. What is it about Balanchine choreography, specifically about his work rather than someone else's?
Mr. Balanchine's influence, I think, coming to America changed dance history on a huge level, just opening so much beauty. It's timeless, his choreography.
Based on a really thorough grounding in classical Russian technique, yeah?
Yes, of course. Foundation is his technique.
And what is it about that technique? It's very strict, isn't it?
Yes, because he has a Russian background. But it's, I think when he came to America, he expanded with his choreography. And I think working on the dancers here in America, he was able to explore so much. And he had such a vision. He was a visionary and changed dance history.
Well, his choreography changed with his exposure to America is kind of what you're saying.
Of course, absolutely.
Because he was, as an artist, you consider him to be really open to influences. You know, I'm thinking of the way he was able to absorb influences outside of ballet.
Yes, absolutely. He did. He changed everything and on such a beautiful level.
Was it becoming a principal dancer in his company, what kind of preparation did that take for you?
Well, I was studied at the School of American Ballet for 3 years, and then I became an apprentice in 1987. And,
at the City Ballet?
At New York City Ballet. And first, about 8 months, I was an apprentice, dancing, learning the ballets. Usually start with the Nutcracker, and then you learn some of the ballet. I think my ballet was Symphony in C. And then you do many ballets, about, I think you have 6 to 8 ballets, and then you find out whether you have gotten in a contract, and I did get a contract, and so I joined and I danced there for 22 years.
When you learn a Balanchine ballet where the details of the choreography are so important, how does that get passed along? You know, in a piece of music, you have a score. It's not quite like that in choreography, is it?
Right.
How does it work?
You have ballet masters that teach you the choreography. Of course, tapes, you do look back at the different dancers and to learn the choreography as well. But you have a set of ballet mistresses that help you through learning the choreography, preparing you for the stage, and And then you're sort of on your own once you get there.
Mm-hmm. There's that whole thing in ballet, once you've got the steps and really are familiar with the music, of only then really can you get into interpretation, yeah?
Yes, absolutely.
So how does that work? How do you become an interpretive artist with all that technique behind you?
For me, it's always been about the music, and sort of always carries me through my dance or my ballet or mm-hmm. whatever I'm going to do. I've always tried to, if I have, we call it the butterflies. Mm-hmm. I've always listened. I think as a dancer, you lean on the foundation of your technique and are able to so spread your wings. And then once you're on the stage, then there's your freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for me personally, it's been a spiritual journey on the stage as well as my strength and my technique. But most important for me has always been the music.
Sure.
Sort of, you know, it tells you the steps. You do have to remember your steps.
Yeah.
But it's such beautiful music, you know, all the music that I've danced to in my career.
How do you pass that along to students? You know, the whole idea of absorbing technique and working with the music and then putting your own interpretation on. That seems to be a lot to absorb.
Yeah, it is. But I think as a student, the students I've worked with here in Hawaii are very open and they're very eager to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So it's when you walk into a room, you're just sharing your knowledge with giving back from all the teachers and all the ballet mistresses and
yeah.
the director that I worked with, Peter Martins. You're giving back, and I think that's what's so important as a teacher.
You're inviting students to come to a free open masterclass.
Correct.
This weekend. What kind of things do you address in a masterclass like that? Masterclass meaning the students already have got some level of proficiency right?
Yes, we hope so. Yes. I think we'll be able to tell more once the students have arrived on what levels. There will probably be different levels, and I'll gear the class around that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's just open. I'm sort of being introduced and at mm-hmm. the Alive Ballet Academy. And I'm looking forward to the community coming out and want to work with the students here. It's very important to me.
Would you, in a class like that, say, offer a sample of Balanchine choreography?
Of course. A variation, maybe.
Uh-huh.
I could do that. But I think just my style of how I teach is different than any other style.
Uh-huh.
And that comes from the years of taking classes, New York City Ballet training, and the School of American Ballet training. So it's hard for me to walk into a room and give any other class, but what I know.
You've had that immersion.
Yes, of course, immersed in it.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Yvonne Bure is a former principal dancer of New York City Ballet, who's recently moved to Oahu, will take over the direction of Honolulu's Alive Ballet Academy next month. She's offering a free open masterclass to all ages on August 26th at 2 p.m. at Live Ballet Academy Studio on McCully Street in Honolulu. She'll be training young local dancers in the Balanchine technique.
Is Hawaii's princess mentally fit? It's the question her former attorney is asking as control of her $200 million fortune hangs in the balance. Civil Beat reporter Nick Ruby joins us now with today's reality check. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Beth Ann. Thanks for having me.
Always good to talk to you. Now, we're talking about Abigail Kauananakoa and whether or not she is mentally competent to be able to handle her fortune after the stroke that she had in June. What makes her attorney think she's not?
Well, her attorney, James Wright, has worked with her for about 20 years. And he felt that after the stroke that she has been acting a little bit differently, at least as he describes his personal interactions with her. But what's more is that doctors have told him as well that she might not be capable of handling her own finances. So he went and took control of her living trust, which the documents say he was allowed to do, and a court has actually approved that process. And of course, that is the point of contention today.
The whole point of having a living trust is to be able to carry on one's wishes if, in fact, one becomes mentally incompetent for whatever reason or physically. But what is it that he feels is so different about what he's been asked to do under the trust versus how she's acting now, particularly the fact that she dismissed him?
Well, I think the big worry here is from Wright's perspective is whether or not she's being taken advantage of. Now, he is particularly concerned about Ms. Kwananakoa's longtime partner, Veronica Gale Worth, who he says has been trying to get more money out of the princess for years now, most recently in March when she asked for another $26 million in James Campbell Company's stock from the princess, a request that Abigail Kwananakoa declined. And James Wright has also accused Ms. Worth of domestic violence and says he has photographic evidence to back that up. That evidence, of course, has been leaked to some members of the press who published images that purportedly are bruises on Ms. Kwananakoa's body. And so his worry is, again, that this month that the princess, the Abigail Kwananakoa is being taken advantage of in an attempt to get more money out of her.
So, you know, what happens now? I mean, of course, she's 91. Things happen when you're that age. People do bruise more easily, perhaps. But what kind of other categorical evidence needs to be brought to bear? And where does this whole issue go from here?
Well, basically, it's in the probate court right now. And a judge is now being asked by James Wright to appoint an independent investigator, or a kokua kanawai, as state law lays out, to sort of review the facts and come to a determination about whether Abigail Kwananakoa is mentally fit and capable of taking her own finances or taking control of her own finances again. James Wright, of course, wants to have independent medical examiners take part in this process because Veronica Gale Worth, again, who he's accused of a money grab, has said via her attorneys that they have hired their own experts. And I don't think James Wright trusts those experts to give an unbiased opinion.
Going to be very interesting to see how this continues and what happens if, in fact, they get that independent look at the princess. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org. Today we spoke with reporter Nick Ruby.
The State House and Senate's Medical Cannabis Legislative Oversight Working Group meets today at 2 p.m. in the state capitol with a number of issues to address. HBR reporter Kuuve Hiraishi has been following the somewhat rocky rollout of Hawaii's first medical marijuana ventures, and we spoke with her about what we can expect from today's hearing.
For the most part, it's going to be a check-in of the Department of Health's updates, and this group has been meeting, let's see, every month for the last year. Mm-hmm. And this is just the first time that they're going to be meeting since the dispensary is open. So they are Senator Roz Baker, who co-chairs the working group of MOE. She said she anticipates a lot of frustration in today's discussions. But the good thing is everyone, the Department of Health, patients, doctors, people are there to answer and ask questions. So it adds that layer of transparency to a sort of Hawaii kind of building this medical marijuana dispensary program.
So whatever information needs to be gathered should be able to be gathered.
Exactly,
today.
Exactly. And I've actually gone through some of the minutes of these working group meetings for the past year, and it seems like a lot of the issues that dispensaries and patients and everyone has been running into has been discussed at these meetings. So it was always just a hypothetical until the dispensaries opened. Then these issues really started to materialize.
Well, the dispensaries opened and promptly closed in some cases, right?
Exactly. And that's a good, you know, I think one of the hot topics at today's meeting is going to be the laboratories and cannabis derivative products. So what happened with Moe Grown Therapies is what you're referring to. They opened on a Tuesday. And then by the next Monday, they had to close shop Monday and Tuesday because they had run out of supply.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing that they didn't anticipate was that they would only be able to test dried cannabis flower.
Right.
So they had gotten put all this money into coming up with oils and tinctures or cannabis derivative products to be sold to their patients who don't want to smoke.
Yeah, and that's a big part of dispensary inventory in other states.
Exactly. And that was a big part of the inventory for Moe Grown. So when they found out that the one laboratory, Steep Hill, that was certified to test products for sale was not certified to test cannabis derivative products, they had to make rapid adjustments. And the best thing they could do was close and wait for their cannabis dried flower to be certified by the lab so that they could go ahead and sell those. So that will definitely be on the agenda today.
Has that put them at some risk, you know, that a large initial investment and a minimal return, given that they can't sell all the products they thought they were going to sell?
It did, and it has had an impact. But for the most part, I think what everyone seems to be looking at is for solutions. They aren't that frustrated to the point where they're just like, oh, the Department of Health just needs to get this done. I think they're sort of wanting to be at the table and say, you know, we didn't know this was going on, so can we tweak things so that we can be able to have that communication. And I think they're looking for solutions to get labs, either Steep Hill, so we only got one lab certified for all of the dispensaries. So to test any product that goes to sale is this one lab on Oahu. Moe Grown had to have their products flown to Oahu to be tested. So that adds to an extra cost to their expenses.
And it adds to the cost to the consumer, which we've heard some complaining about, right?
Exactly. And I looked into that. So Moe Grown Therapies said a gram of marijuana that they sell ranges from 19 to 24, which is somewhat competitive. Black markets, you can go as low as 10 to 20.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't sound like it's really having that impact, but I have heard that from others in the game and other folks that are in this industry.
What kind of immediate, I mean, we probably can't expect immediate resolution, but what kind of steps do you think we can expect from today?
So I asked about that, you know, what's coming out of this. Eventually, the ultimate goal of the working group is to give legislative recommendations for the next session. So it is too early to anticipate what that will look like. But I think what Carl Berquist, who is the executive director of the Drug Policy Forum of Hawaii, what he had mentioned is what needs to happen now is we can't anticipate that it's going to take a while to get all the labs up and running, all the dispensaries up and running. So let's come up with ways to serve our patients in that interim. So, for example, only Maui and Oahu patients are being served right now. Big Island, Kauai, dispensaries are not open, but those patients are waiting for medicine. So he was saying to sort of work on the transport of medicine, laws that deal with transport of medicine
make
to allow them
exactly
to allow them to go and fly to Maui, go to the dispensary, take their medicine home until these dispensaries can get ready to open.
HPR reporter Ku'uwe Hiraishi's story on the issues at stake in today's hearing will run today from between 4 and 6 during All Things Considered. The hearing itself will begin at 2 p.m. in Conference Room 309 at the Hawaii State Capitol.
Hawaii experiences little of the self-described alt-right, but the recent events in Charlottesville and President Trump's response evoke strong reactions here, too. As the alt-right becomes a more visible and active part of American politics, one of their goals seems to be a making over of the GOP in the alt-right's image. But at this stage, what is the alt-right, and what do its supporters believe, and how likely is it to affect politics in future? Some very recent research has some answers to that. Contributing editor Neil Milner reviewed it, and he's here to give us a look. Hi, Neil.
Hi, Bethann.
So one of these pieces of research that you looked at is only a few weeks old. It's only been out for a couple of weeks. What did these researchers find, and where are they from?
Well, the one that looked at a psychological profile, a very thorough psychological study using a lot of the usual stuff, it's from Patrick Forsher at the University of Arkansas and Noor Kateli from Northwestern University. What they did was to identify very carefully, people would self-identify as alt-right members of the alt-right. They would very carefully check whether that was that category made sense to these people. They found 400 people who were identified with the alt-right roughly, and they took those people and compared them to 300 people who are not alt-right members. And they found out a pretty clear, compelling psychological profile of what members of the alt-right are like. And the first thing to understand about it is that even though we regularly now talk about implicit bias, there's a lot of research that says we're all biased, our eyes blink in certain ways, we don't know it. They want to make sure you understand this is explicit, this is extrinsic bias. They reflect a kind of set of behavior and attitudes that is right out there. They express prejudice. They see whites as victimized. They don't approve of any kind of Black Lives Matter movement. They're much more likely to harass people. They have behavior that harasses people on the basis of race, and they tend to dehumanize other groups that are different from them. This is compared to the other sample. They're just much more likely to express in a positive way the fact that they're prejudiced, the fact that they're whites, and they feel that they're being taken advantage of.
Okay, so that's one study. What about the other one?
Well, the other study took a look at the literature that's written on websites and so on to look at what these people really want to do rather than a psychological profile. And what they found out, more about strategies and what they want to find out, they found out two things that are very interesting, one of which did not surprise me and the other surprised me a little bit more. The one that did not surprise me is that the modern alt-right tends to talk in the same language of rights and discrimination that the civil rights movement did, only now they see themselves as victimized. They see themselves as being as white people being deprived of rights because of people of color who are getting all the advantages. And they also talk in terms of multiculturalism, which simply says, hey, multiculturalism should include us white people also. That result didn't surprise me because I know how rights language tends to work, and this has been in other places. The more interesting one is that a lot of this literature is very clear that what they want to do is to racialize the Republican Party. Their goal is essentially, and this shows up in a lot of the literature, is to make this kind of alt-right basis the basis of the Republican Party.
When you put both of those studies together, what is the profile of the person who is an alt-right, and what does that alt-right mean now? That phrase has been bandied about for quite a while since, you know, we had the election, and there's been a lot of cautions, especially from the AP, about using that and what that really means, because it's still so fuzzy. When you now have a psychological profile of someone who is self-described alt-right and also a body of white supremacist literature that appeals to them, what does that mean for the rest of us?
Well, the first thing is just a word of caution on the basis of what you just said. Alt-right, like all kinds of terms that become political terms, they get thrown around and they become accusatory and not very analytical. But generally what alt-right meant to the people who studied it here is that these people were They basically overall tended to be either white supremacist or populist in the sense of not liking elites and so on. Both of those groups tended to be very white nationalistic. White supremacy means just that. You tend to see the white people as supreme. It's a rough coalition, and it's very hard to identify any kind of specific sort of way now. But we have to remember that Charlottesville organized protest, not the counter-protest, the protest that the alt-right had something to do with, was an attempt to take all of these groups and to begin to build a coalition from the KKK to anti-Semites to others. So there is clearly that kind of movement. Like anything else, it's inchoate, it's in flux. But that generally is what the alt-right means.
You spoke a moment ago about trying to, you know, racialize the Republican Party. And we've been seeing these attempts to make over the GOP in an alt-right image. What does that really look like? How do you racialize the Republican Party when it's so factionalized?
Well, that's the idea of racializing the Republican Party to make white supremacy and even white nationalism the key issue is a pretty big dream for now. But we have to remember certain things about race and certain things about white people and certain things about Republicans that have been around for a long time. First of all, race played a very important issue in the 2016 election. That racial resentment shows up, white resentment shows up as one of the key factors that predicted whether they were going to vote for Trump. But there's a broader history than that. The parties are really divided to a great extent on the basis of race in terms of the way they vote. The majority of white people vote Republican, and a heavy majority of people of color vote Democratic. So you have this kind of racialization of politics already. I'm not saying that that's at all like what the white alt-right would like down the road, or especially what the white supremacists would like down the road. But there clearly is a movement toward bringing alt-right, white supremacy, white identity politics into the mainstream. It's talked about a lot more than it has been in the past. Breitbart, which is not necessarily racial, but certainly is some of it is the most popular right-wing news segment. And certainly whatever else President Trump has done, he has, in the eyes of the white identity people, legitimated their cause. That is, that it's made it possible for them to come forward, whether he explicitly approves or not, to come forward and to make this part of the political discourse. This is not the old-fashioned KKK, but it's still very much along the line of a kind of white resentment, identity, anti-elite stuff that we have not really seen to this extent in politics for a long time.
We've got to go in just a second, but as we're here in Hawaii and we're watching this happen largely on the mainland, what is it that you think that we can look at in a way or bring to the discussion perhaps that we have not heard from others on the mainland? Does Hawaii have a role in this?
You know what? It's too easy to say that Hawaii would be a model for behaving in another sort of way. That simply is not the case, not because Hawaii... I'm not saying Hawaii has the same kind of issues and the same kind of problems, but the situation here is different. There is no Republican Party. There isn't the kind of active sort of thing. But we really don't have something that we can say that would be anything other than mealy-mouthed about how you should behave.
Well, I bet you get some comments about there is no Republican Party here. Neil, thanks so very much.
I've said it before.
We'll talk to you again.
Sure.
Neil Milner is a retired professor of political science and contributes to our segment, The Long View.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we remember the last independent Ali'i Nui, the ruler of Kauai and Niihau, until his surrender to the warrior king Kamehameha in 1810. Kamehameha had been trying to conquer Kauai since 1796. His first attempt was diverted by the threat of a rebellion back home on Hawaii Island. The second, in 1803, was halted by a disease among his troops. The third led him to assemble an armada unlike any seen in this waters, complete with European cannon. Kamehameha's shock and awe tactic worked. Kauai's king capitulated to avoid bloodshed, and Kaumualii continued to serve his people as a vassal of Kamehameha with the title of governor until his death in 1824.
And we heard from Carly Oliva, who called us from Waipahu, knew the answer, and will be receiving the Backyard Quiz tote bag. Now, if you've got a Backyard Quiz question for us, you can always send it in. Our address is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
When does a workspace become something more? When it's an impact hub, or so say the founders of Impact Hub Honolulu, a 14,000-square-foot co-working space aimed at the small business person and the young entrepreneur, the people who are now plying their trade at home or in coffee shops because the cost of a traditional workspace is out of reach. George Yarbrough is the founder of the co-working space Impact Hub Honolulu, which has a soft opening today on Queen Street in Kaka'ako, and he's with us by phone. Hi, George.
Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for having me on.
Pleasure to talk to you. It looks as if you've really found a kind of a gap group of people in business who aren't quite ready to, you know, lease a big corner facility.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the Impact Hub is a co-working and event and office space that is designed to facilitate sustainable impact through collaboration and empowering communities. And so we provide that space or that platform for people to kind of get off the ground, start their business, even if you're a freelancer, or even if this is your third, second, whatever business, you have the opportunity to have a membership at a space, free coffee, awesome Wi-Fi, and there's people around you who can help with your business. For example, if you working next to a photographer and you need some photos of some products on your line and you're building up a website. I mean, those serendipitous collisions are what co-working is all about and why it's so important.
Is this a growing trend, do you think?
Absolutely. I mean, if you look, I think it is. And Hawaii, you know, again, is catching on a little bit slower than the mainland and international. But, I mean, you're looking at some larger companies like WeWork is now valued at $17 billion, and they started, I believe, in 2007. I mean, the whole concept of co-working has kind of blown up in the last 10 years, the last decade. So you're really seeing this opportunity for young businesses, small businesses, and entrepreneurs to take advantage of it and leverage co-working for their own business sake.
Well, you know, where does the line get drawn between synergy with other people getting their business off the ground and, you know, and distraction? I mean, if I'm going to work in a co-working space, that means there's an awful lot going on around me that isn't necessarily to do with what I'm trying to get done, right?
Yeah. No, that's a good point. So I think one of the keys to a good co-working space is a diverse space. So you can have a corner or a section of the space that is allowed for or open to kind of that open collaboration, kind of louder conversations. And then if you have nooks and other areas that are specific for put your head down and get in the groove of working, then that will allow you to kind of move and flow in between the spaces that are kind of suited for your mood that day. You know, there are times when you just kind of want to talk and you want to be social. And then that's when those kind of serendipitous collisions, like I mentioned earlier, happen. But then again, let's think about what the other options are for startups and freelancers. One being working from home. And I mean, I know that very well because that's one reason why I'm starting this, is that working from home, I mean, what do? You try to work, but also you do a lot of dishes. You do a lot of housework. Mm-hmm. And then the other option would be to work from a coffee shop where you kind of have to, you know, hustle to get your space, especially if you have a meeting with a client or a customer. It's sometimes can be difficult to seem presentable, to seem professional, and working out of a coffee shop.
Well, you know, back in the day when everybody felt the need to have an office, an awful lot of your cost of running the business went into having a facility.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean that's why this is kind of successful and why we're doing this is to be that support system, right? We are a platform for others to grow and to realize their own impact, whether it be a foundation or it be a business or a nonprofit. So I mean our memberships start at $30 a month and they go up to 24/7 memberships at $215 a month. So you have that variety and that scale so that you can choose what you can afford and you can choose what works best for you. In addition to that, I would like to mention that part of our impact is that we have raised funds for scholarships. So entrepreneurs and other people who believe that what they're doing is creating an impact, they can apply for a scholarship that we have raised funds for, so that they can be sponsored and be a scholar here at the Impact Hub Honolulu. So that will provide that the opportunity for accelerated growth for someone who is just getting started.
Well, George, if you mentioned there are different levels at which you sign up. Let's say I want to start a business and I want to join up with you, but you know, I'm at that very uncertain phase of getting started. What are at the beginning level? What do I get? It means I can come in and get a desk and use the Wi-Fi whenever I want, or how does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, we have what we're doing right now is we're building out, like you said, 14,000 square feet of dynamic, suitable spaces for events and, for co-working. So you can either work in a quiet zone or work in a social zone. And at $30 a month, and you can cancel whenever you want, but we want to make it as flexible as possible for everyone out there. You can come in and work twice a month. In addition, if you want to work more, you can just pay $10 a day. And what you get with that is you get the free free coffee. So if you think about it, working at a coffee shop, sometimes you can spend more than $10 a day. We will have snacks and food available from a, local cafe. We will also have the blazing Wi-Fi, and you're able to just hang out the entire day and work and make those connections and make that networking happen. And one of the things that we provide is, you know, our team is relatively connected, actually very connected in the entrepreneur world. So if we always have a host available to greet you. And so if, let's say, Chris, you come into the space and we talk and, I find out what your idea is, and especially if it's just getting started, I can make suggestions on who you should speak to, who are those people that you need to talk to for getting your business off the ground and making the, that network for you started, making that network happen for you.
And ideally, that person with whom you might interact might be right there in the same space, yeah?
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, the idea is instead of an email, which is also great, and or a phone call or a text, but to actually walk you over and make introduction to Jeff Hawes, photographer, for example, I mean, that would be exactly what would accelerate that connection for you and your business.
Well, we will watch with interest to see how this all develops, George. Thanks very much for talking
with us. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
George Yarbrough is the founder of the co-working space Impact Hub Honolulu, which has a soft opening today on Queen Street in Kaka'ako.
Aloha, this is Jim Moffat. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
There are a lot of different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host Derek Malama keeps track of them. He joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar, one of them being a comedic murder mystery.
Yes, it's a local-style whodunit that premieres tomorrow in Honolulu. Kumukahua Theater stages Who Killed Gilbert Botello? Detective Roy Kalawa Kekahuna and his sidekick, Billy Souza, try to solve the case. So you know it's Hawaii already, right?
You sure do.
In this murder mystery slash comedy. It debuts tomorrow night at 8 at Kumukahua. So for ticket information, please go to our website.
That's intriguing. I want to find out more about
that.
And here's a chance to learn about ancient Hawaiian stone tools.
This talk is taking place tomorrow in Hilo. A UH Hilo anthropology professor, Peter Mills, will present an overview of his work with Professor Steve Lundblad. And their work has helped define the role of the Mauna Kea adze quarry on the Big Island and also other stone tool quarries in ancient Hawaii. So this is kind of something I never knew about.
Yeah,
really.
Me neither.
So yeah, so this happens. It's happening tomorrow at 7 in UH Hilo's Wentworth, room number 1, and the talk is free.
Perhaps most importantly, it's free,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's the main thing.
And speaking of free, here's a free family pauhana tomorrow at UH Manoa.
Uncle Wayne and the Howling Dog Band will entertain at Manoa Gardens in Hemingway Hall. And you and your kid, you can sing and dance. Food and adult beverages are available as well. It's from 5 to 7 p.m. at Manoa Gardens in Hemingway Hall on the UH Manoa campus tomorrow.
Uncle Wayne and the Howling Dog Band.
I'm
suitably intrigued, right? Thanks a lot, Derek.
Sure, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
We're coming up to the top of the hour, and that's going to do it for us for today on The Conversation. Coming up tomorrow on Town Square, what about Hawaii's ugly history? What did we do about it? We'll talk about it tomorrow. We'll hope you'll plan to join us for Town Square tomorrow at 11.
And we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at our talkback line and leave your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
And if you missed any part of this show or you just want to hear something else again, take a look at The Conversation page. It has links to more information about guests and topics, and you can hear shows and parts of the shows again. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you tomorrow for Town Square.